Accession number 18463, Reel 6.
Ron Barrett, Reel 6.
On the morning of the 22nd, we've been standing to all night, as we had done every night, 50% since the 4th when we went into the Nactong. And at just about half hour after full light, we stood down. And by this time, everybody was very, very tired, although this particular morning, because of the attack, I think probably the adrenaline was running and we were all rather wide awake. Right. And the other problem, which you were all suffering from, was dysentery in various degrees, rather severe in most cases. So we hadn't had time that night to dig the normal, we used to dig a refuse pit, urinal and toilet. So we all popped off with our shovels and did our morning bits. And I was back on the line again. We were on the extreme right of the platoon line with our LMG, and I saw four platoon going up the road. That was Chris Lawrence, who was so tall that he stuck out. Watched them go by, because we were rather proud of four platoon, because we'd all been training NCOs in there. They went off down the road. Shortly after, we didn't hear much firing, but they apparently had attacked and been held. And the rumour, and this is all rumour now, we don't know this to be true or not, but the rumour came that the tanks, the reconnaissance company tanks, were refusing to go forward and support them. They wanted to lay back and fire from where they were, which, funny enough, thought in retrospect, is quite good tactical sense, because they could, up close, they wouldn't have been able to fire so well at the top of the hills, but that wasn't quite how we saw it at the time. And about an hour later, I guess, time's very difficult to assess. A and D Company then started going in the other order, actually, D Company leading, followed by A, on the right-hand side of what we later called Middlesex Hill, Hill 325. And they got held up because American artillery was firing on the hill, and we could see these enormous great shell bursts up on the crest. They were 155 shells, and they had difficulty stopping that. The CO eventually, through the Brigadier presumably, eventually got this under control, and an FFO came up, although we knew nothing of this, you'll appreciate. We were then drawn back, our platoon, 6th platoon was drawn back to where Company HQ had been overnight. And there was a couple of trenches there, and we made use of them, but mainly we were laid out on the ground there. And then very heavy mortaring came down across the front, right across where our section positions have been, across the front of the road, and on the crest of the hill where the reconnaissance company were. For some reason, the reconnaissance company had dug on right on the crest of the hill instead of just going forward where they were, so they were skylined all the time. And there was a fairly hectic scene up there as they leapt out their trenches and ran to others, but I have no idea why. Well, I have an idea why, is because a mortar bomb the previous day had dropped in a trench and they were a little bit concerned that another one mightn't kill them. And just shortly after that, a young chap came round the corner, and I was actually standing up in this little slit trench here, and he said, "That's my slit trench, I need that." I thought, well, fair enough, you know, get in. I thought, what's the matter? He was a stretcher bearer. They'd gone down to bring down the wounded from 4th Platoon. And the American MO, this company, had an actual MO itself, which I perhaps that's the American way, I don't know. And they'd gone down. They got up the left-hand side of the hill instead of going up the right-hand side where 4th Platoon had gone up. They tried to get up the left-hand side and they got badly shot up. And he'd had a bit of a struggle getting back along the gully. I don't know how many of them were. I think, there was the American MO had been killed, as had one of the stretcher bearers, a chap named Bristow. And basically, there was a little bit of a scrimmage. What had actually happened was that a section of about 10 Gooks had been bypassed by virtue of 4th Platoon going up the right-hand side of the what was now being known as Plum Pudding Hill, which in fact was a double hill. We hadn't known that at the time, but it is two pimples, and it was the fire pimple that was Plum Pudding. And they'd actually overlooked this section, who were just covering the road. They'd laid doggo when their friends were knocked off the top of the hill. And when the stretcher party came up with the MO, they'd opened fire on them, and the poor old MO was apparently got out his 45 and tried to look over the top, and from about 20 yards range he got a shot, which we eventually found out had gone through the bridge of his glasses, and they split aside. He was killed. Bristow was hit in the back and died shortly after, and this chap got away. There may have been others with him. I don't really know, because I'm really only saying what I actually saw at that moment of time. There are things that I found out later, but they aren't really as I saw them at that moment of time. So we stayed there for quite a while, and a move. We were now, of course, unfortunately, of course, the CO now has got two companies involved on 325, B Company with a third of it occupying Plum Pudding, and he's only really got two platoons in reserve now, five platoons, six platoons. So he has to now involve these two platoons on to support four. I think five might have gone up first. I'm not entirely sure on that, because we went down and righted the jeep that had been the reconnaissance jeep, which had been pushed over its side. And just about this time, three or four lorries turned up with shells and fuel and what have you. And the drivers sort of leapt out and moved away from them. And we said, well, what's the panic? And they said, well, it's fuel and ammo, and we don't actually want to get be sitting in their lorries when this happened. They went up on the crest and began shooting out over the crest, you see. So I went up with Ken Partridge and I said, what are you shooting at? They said, they're attacking from that way. Well, actually, what there was two or three civilians out in the, or people in civilian clothes out in the fields there, and they were shooting at them, and they just dropped down. I don't suppose they hit them, you know. But we stopped them firing, and shortly after this, we were ordered to form up and told that we were going up the road on the right-hand side, but we would expect there was a machine gun firing directly on the road, so we'd have to take a lot of care. As it happened, the machine gunners were all dead, but, I mean, we didn't actually know that at the time. So we went up and dug in on the smaller pimple before Plum Pudding on the left-hand side, covering the road and overlooking the place where the section had shot up the stretcher bearers. And Bristow was just down in the paddy below us, and the MO was up on the bank. His helmet had come off, and we were wondering where his 45 was, but that's another story, because we're always looking for 45 automatics and carbine bayonets and carbines. They were sort of things that we all wanted at that time. Anyway, we dug in, and the expectation was that the enemy would probably attack from the other hill, which was like 282, and come across the river and attack us up that way. As it happened, they didn't. There was nothing during the night. Three tanks had now moved up, and they eventually came up and sort of hugged us up on the paddy on a little low plateau just below our positions. And we had a quiet night, except for shells. Shells were now going off down the river, the Nacton crossing, and occasionally, well, one did land on 325 and killed a chap named Sharp about midnight. But we've been very, very lucky. I can't remember how many dead there were in, because one died of wounds later. But four platoon had about four or five dead, something like that, and a number of wounded. D Company had had quite a number wounded, and two dead, one in the assault, the platoon commander, and Sharp, Sharp apparently was a great big tall chap, and he hadn't dug in deep enough, and his head was stuck up above the level of his slit trench asleep, and the shell dropped and killed him. And And the following day, following morning, was very, very cold, icy cold. Frost, we were in JG, of course, at that time. And suddenly we heard these tanks start up, heard the engines start, the sound is travelling, you know, extremely well. And we heard the old tracks clatter as they came out of their highs, and they fired a few rounds at us. And then shortly after that, we were mortared. But again, the sound was quite incredible. You could hear the bombs going down the tube and hear them rattling down the tube, the explosion, and of course often they were coming over our way. They didn't actually land near us. I guess they probably landed up on 325, somewhere like that. But it was quite impressive to hear the tank tracks. Quite frightening, really, I think. And to hear these going down the tube. I never heard it again after. Well, I heard it again there the following day. But after this particular battle, I never heard that again, actually. Quite as frightening as that. Anyway, the Argylls were going to attack early in the morning, as we were standing to, they made their attack on what was literally in front of us, although in fact on the left flank of the battalion. They brought a company forward and had a little knoll, and the two companies had formed up on a little stream on the left-hand side. We didn't see this, we didn't even hear it. At first, we were actually at breakfast. We stood down. And we actually heard a hunting horn go. And we knew it was the Argylls because one of their officers had got an enormous bone hunting horn in a leather case across his back. So we guess that was him. And a shout and a cheer and a few shots and what have you. And virtually another little bit of shooting after that. And it seemed like it was all over. You know, they'd captured the hill. Which indeed they had, of course, and everything was okay. And I'll be honest, we relaxed and sat down and thought, well, that's great, you know, we've captured this side of the road, the Argylls have captured that, job's more or less done. Anyway, we didn't hear any more foreign at all. There was probably a lot of it going on, but one of the things about Korea, any hilly country, is that the sound is swamped and you could be fighting a vicious battle over the other side of the hill and you'll hear nothing on this side, sort of thing, you know. So we were going along about our normal sort of duties, whatever they were, 50% stand to again, and we sent a party up to 4 platoon to bring down the dead, and also we sent a party up to 4 platoon to bring down their dead, and they carried them down on the stretchers and just above us. It was a horrible shout, because as they came down the slope, the blood had collected in the poor old lad's uniform, and it came out of the stretcher and shot out like a big gusher all over the front two lads. They dropped the stretcher, and there was a bit of a kerfuffle there, and a little bit of, you know, get a grip of yourselves bits, and they took off the dead from 4. And we, about midday, I would guess, it might have been a little bit earlier, I can't remember what the Americans had a number for them, but it was the old Harvard from the war days, came over, and they were spotter planes for artillery, because there'd been no artillery at this time. And he came over and had a look and began to circle round where we thought the Argylls were. Well, in fact, we were convinced the Argylls were there. And he went round a couple of times. And then some Mustangs came, flight of Mustangs came over, and they circled round two or three times. And the Harvard fired, I presume, very lights or rockets or something or other like that, down onto the place where we thought the Argylls were. And we thought, that's funny, we must have made a mistake. They must be on the hill at the other end. We must have got it wrong way around, you see. Went on doing whatever comes naturally. And suddenly, the Mustangs began to attack the hill. And it seemed incredible. They were circling around, dropping napalm, cannons, machine guns, the whole lot, you know. We we were still thinking, well, I don't know, that it can't be down the other end, the Argyles, because we'd never heard them. We wouldn't have heard the hunting horn or anything like that. And eventually they expended all their napalm and cannons and what have you, and one of them then came round and actually shot up the Argyle A Company, who we could see. We could see them sort of sideways on. We could see their heads on the... And we sort of ducked down, and I said to them, I said, this can't be. That's A Company down there. They're shooting up A Company now. And we... A slight bit of a panic here, and we all stood too, actually, at that time, in the trenches. And then the word came that, of course, they'd attacked the Argyles. They hadn't hit the... They hit the wrong hill. And it all went quiet for a bit, and there was a great mass of flame up on the hill, which began to sweep down the side of the hill, and everything burning. And then I couldn't tell you how much longer after that, because time is very difficult to assess when you're under a certain amount of strain. I was on guard, doing my 50%, and there was a... I could see a line of people coming down the hill towards us. And I thought, well, that's funny, that's the Argyles, they're coming down the hill. And it was just a big sort of snaky line. And we all sort of began to watch them through the field glasses and what have you. And I thought, that's funny, they're covered in soot. They're all black. Must be just wet, because jungle green goes blackish colour when it gets wet. Slowly this column began to weave towards us, and suddenly we realised it was their wounded that were coming back. And as they got a bit nearer, there was the whole platoon, every man in the platoon, leapt out of his trench and went to help them, went running down to help them. And the company commander came forward and tried to stop us. The CSM came forward, and I was one of the last to run down the hill. And Jimmy Wilde, the CSM, grabbed me round the waist and grabbed the chap by me and held us and said, go back, go back. You've got to cover this thing. So we went back up the hill and got the LMG out, because the gooks are now firing on the column and on the wounded and everything else, you know. And my friend Kev Partridge had run down with his camera. And he was the only chap that had a camera that I was aware of. And there, of course, when he got down there, he couldn't take pictures. It was just such a ghastly sight. And he stuck his Sting gun in the ground with a bayonet, and his camera was hanging over it, you know. And gradually, there was a great mound of blankets and things like that. They were bringing them in on, not on stretchers, because they had one or two stretchers, but, I mean, basically, they were bringing them in on blankets and ground sheets, and it was a terrible sight, because some of them were burned so badly that the flesh was literally falling off their skin, you know. And this is the most terrible sight. I can only describe them like miners just coming up from the pit. A lot of them didn't have their hats on. We were not, by this time incidentally, we were not wearing steel helmets. We were wearing cap comforters. Steel helmets had got a bit heavy. And it was a terrible scene there. It was even worse for us, because we couldn't go down and help, and that's the terrible thing. But by this time, they were shooting at the jeeps were coming out, and they were shooting at the jeeps and at the wounded and the helpers with anti-tank rifles, which are a little bit hefty, you know, thing. And they knocked out two jeeps, two American jeeps that came forward through the radiator. And then there was a great pile of blankets there, and which was building up about 4 or 5 feet high, you know, bloodstained blankets. And gradually, the wounded were moved away. But some of my lads, in fact, one of my section, they had actually gone up the hill, and a chap named Nixon, he went up the hill, and four of them began to try and slide this guy down the hill on a stretcher. And an officer called out to him, drop him and run. And they wouldn't. One of the bearers was killed. And Nick got the whole end. A little tiny chap he was. He looked about 12 years old. Got the end. And the other two got on the front end. And they slid him down the hill and got him away. And it all began to quiet down a bit now. We couldn't see where these wretched anti-tank rifles were to return fire. And we dare not fire, because of the Argyles who were spreading out over the hill. Some of them we thought were Argyles ran down the side of the hill, and some carriers went out to pick them up and never found them, so we reckon they must have been Gooks coming down the side of the hill and, you know, chasing after them. And there was a lot of long-range fire, and it all began to quieten down, and the wounded were beginning to be moved off, and an Argyle section spread out, nicely spread out, began to move across over towards our A company. And it must have been the anti-tank rifle, I should think, because suddenly, this is all slow motion, there's no sound of this at all, this is a silent film. Suddenly, one of them slung his arms up in the air, and his rifle, which was in his hands, just shot up above his head, and he slumped down, and then somebody came back and had a look at him, and I guess it was the anti-tank rifle that hit him, because that would be a half-inch slug would have hit him. And they left him and went on. And it began to all calm down, and we realised then that, you know, there'd been this terrible tragedy. The Harvard, incidentally, when he went off, he flew over Middlesex Hill, waggling his wing, you know, job well done sort of thing, you know, fantastic. And I think we thought the same, yes, you have done a good job, but we didn't realise then it was the Argyles he'd done the job on. We cleared the air chaps down below, cleared the wounded, so that was like our 6th platoon who had literally abandoned their positions against all the rules and regulation and gone down to help, except for the two of us. And they gradually cleared everything away, and our lads drifted back up to us, those that were there, because some had gone off down with the wounded to the right down to the Nactong, as far as that. They got a guy, and they were determined to see him safe and sound, one of which was young Nicky. And they came back up, Ken came up, and I said to him, "Hey, your blooming camera's still down there with a Sten gun." "Ah, oh, firm me down." Because it's under fire by this time. This guy with the anti-tank rifle's popping away there. Anything had moved out there. And he went down, got in the ditch, waited for a bit until there was a cease in the firing. Ran out, grabbed his Sten and his camera, and did the right thing, ran forward and hid behind this pyramid of blankets, which must have been 4 or 5 feet high by this time. And this guy with the anti-tank rifle was bopping into this pile of blankets, and we could see Ken trying to lay as straight as he could behind this this pile of blankets. And every time the shot hit the blankets, he absorbed it, and they just went boom, boom. And eventually he leapt up after he'd fired a shot, because his anti-tank rifle was a bolt action, you've got a little bit of time. And he ran back to the ditch and then eventually came back up to us again. And the word came then that as soon as it was dark, we could expect a real full-scale assault across this little stream. It was a moonlight night, I remember. And we had a fairly hectic night. The hill was burning all night long. In fact, it was burning even 2 or 3 days later when we actually left. And you could watch the moon sort of shimmering on the water, but they didn't attack as it happened. But the following morning, it was getting a bit warm now, and the guys, the 10 or 12 of them that had been killed on this little hill, were beginning to pong a bit. So Gus, the platoon commander, took Ken's section over and they tried to bury them, but they only dig little holes, unfortunately, little round little holes which they sort of curl up in, and they had a bit of a job to sort of fold them round and bury them. And they got finished, and Ken was having a bit of trouble with his because he couldn't get his head down a little bit, you know. And he gave it trying to pat the soil down over the top of it, and the Gooks up on the hill took umbrage at that and began to snipe him, so he nipped off and left that. They brought all the arms back. There were LMGs, rifles, this sniping rifle, because this sergeant that had hit the MO in the forehead had got a sniping rifle. They came back with that, and at the same time whilst they were doing this, the party had come out and taken in the MO and Bristow, who had been there for about 24 hours, I guess. And they took them in. They cleared all the dead, buried the dead, and put them away. And there was one last chap laying on a little pathway just below the hill, which the majority of them had been on. I guess he'd run down there. And we saw this chap sort of turn him over and tip him into the gully, and our bodies have a habit of expelling the air inside them, which is a bit unpleasant. And we saw him go, ooh, as this terrible smell came up to him. But anyway, we buried them all, and that was it. The expectation was then, of course, that we would attack next day, morning, we would attack 282, because the Argyles are now down to one A company and B and C have amalgamated the remains of B and C into one company, so they've only got about 200 riflemen left. Anyway, we didn't attack the next day for reasons which are explained in the histories and what have you, and it was probably the following day that we were going to move, the following day, that would be like the third day, the fourth day, we were going to move forward into Songju. It was said that the enemy, I think it was one of the American RCTs had come down from the other way and had driven them out of Songju, and we were going to go forward and occupy it. Well, overnight, the carriers came up lagered in the on a little bit of flat ground below us, and about midnight there'd been people began to come through this little narrow gully at the bottom of the of our hill, and it was obvious they were obvious they were civilians. Unfortunately, my friend who was commanding the right hand section at that time, the Lance Corporal, he gave a fire order, and they opened fire on these civilians. And, of course, they're firing into the poor old carriers who were crouching down in their carriers. And I stood up and said some rude words and got them to cease fire, stopped them all. And unfortunately, of course, that put paid to Bill's chances of being section commander, because the following day I took over his section, and he was my 2IC. So I'm afraid that was a great pity. I can't understand how he, unless he dozed off or something and suddenly woke up and thought they were attacking us. I don't know quite how he made that mistake. It seemed so obvious to me that they were civilians. The unfortunate thing is, if one person fires, everybody else will. Everybody follows suit. There's no lone shots. Everybody else is so tensed up they want to fire a few shots. A little bit difficult to stop them. But anyway, we did stop them. But I think one of the problems had been a patrol had gone out earlier on, and the previous day, went out the previous day, and we saw this chap get up out the gully, after they'd gone through, get up out the gully and run after them. And we thought somebody's lace or something like that has come undone, he's just followed on. Didn't have a hat on, which was a bit unusual, and we never thought any more of it. But unfortunately, the next morning there was a mine in the gully there. So I guess he'd been a North Korean laying a mine, and he'd had. It's a good thing to follow a patrol out, because nobody knows who you are. Then you just dart off to the side, and I think that maybe had made Bill a little bit alert to things like that. Anyway, the following morning I took over his second as ham. But following morning we went down on the road and fell in. And D and A companies came down off of Middlesex Hill, and there they hadn't had enough water, so they'd had a no shaving competition to see who would grow the biggest beard, much I might add to the CO's disgust. And he came along and